Today on Maine Calling, women and girls with disabilities. Most people living with a disability face obstacles in our society, but the challenges for women and girls can be compounded. Women with disabilities are more likely to be unemployed than men. Women with disabilities experience a much higher rate of sexual abuse, especially women and girls with developmental disabilities. Many simply feel they are invisible to others, despite all the talents they have to offer. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we learn how these difficulties affect women and girls in Maine and worldwide, and what can be done to help. A note, this Maine Calling program is being live streamed with an ASL interpreter on YouTube and Maine Calling's Facebook page. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Having a disability means overcoming obstacles in our society, and for women and girls, there are often added layers of problems to face. Today, we will learn about how being female and having a disability can be linked to abuse and other challenges worldwide and here in Maine. We are broadcasting today's program on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Calling's Facebook page. And we have an ASL interpreter joining us as well. Joining me for this hour, Michelle Ames, Program Director of Deaf Services with Disability Rights Maine. She is deaf and she is a teacher of American Sign Language. Kim Moody is also with Disability Rights Maine. She is the Executive Director and a woman with a disability, a lifelong disability rights advocate. And Maria Omare is a disability inclusion advocate, a social entrepreneur, and educator. She is founder and executive director of the Action Foundation. She is here in Maine this week as the keynote speaker for the Justice for Women lecture series, which takes place this Thursday evening, that's tomorrow evening, at 6:30 p.m. at the University of Southern Maine's Hannaford Hall. We invite you to join the conversation. What is your lived experience? Do you live with a disability or have a loved one who does? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And also, again, you can tune in to Maine Calling's Maine Public's YouTube channel or Maine Calling's Facebook page to watch today's show. Thank you all for being here today. Maria, I will start with you. Welcome to Maine. I understand that a big part of the work you do involves research on the reality that women with disabilities face all over the world. What are some of the findings that you think are most important for people to understand?
Thank you so much, Jennifer, and I'm really, really honored and excited to be at the Maine Public Radio. The Action Foundation is a Kenyan-based charity. We work nationally to support girls and women with disabilities to work against the exclusion, discrimination, and violence they face. We have done quite a bit of research, mostly in really low-income communities. A research we did in 2020 in Kibera, which is the largest slum in Africa, found that girls and women with disabilities were experiencing really adverse rates of violence. Many of them were experiencing intimate partner violence with their men that they were living with, and they were at a higher risk of neglect by their carers.
And Kim, as you listen to Maria, her research she was talking about happens in low-income slums in another country, on another continent. But that doesn't mean that discrimination and disadvantage happens here in the U.S., correct?
Absolutely, Jennifer. I think that in most cultures, the combination of male preference and the universal devaluation of disability really does cause unique challenges for women with disabilities. I think that there are really specific examples of that. One is sterilization, which you know about. Poor records have been kept in Maine over the years about how many women were sterilized, but it was not uncommon for many, many years for women who had been essentially put away in Pineland or Augusta Mental Health Institute or Bangor Mental Health Institute. So of the records that were kept, we know that 86% of the people that were sterilized because people didn't think they should be mothers were women. And unemployment rates are highest among women with disabilities. That's another terrible example. Third, I would say that studies, like Maria said, and I concur, that's so true here. Studies here show that women and girls with disabilities are twice as likely to experience gender-based violence compared to women and girls without disabilities. So we're talking about rape and sexual assault and domestic abuse and trafficking, all of the gender-based violence. And another one is that women with disabilities are often denied reproductive health care. And when services are available, they're often not physically accessible. And that's true across healthcare, all across healthcare, I think. So those are some of the ways. I think that, you know, just being female has been considered to be a disabling condition, right? We were, the arguments against us being able to vote were basically that we were just too disabled. So I think it is a long history of being compared, of women with disabilities being sort of at the lowest end of the pole. And that doesn't even take into consideration race. But anyway.
Maria, you... I mentioned at the beginning that you do research, but you also try to put programs into place to empower people, to make communities more resilient. And I know that resilient is sort of an overused word. Tell us what you do on the ground. What is the work that you are doing? Give us some examples.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. So we run a program which is called Ibuka, which in Kiswahili translates to SOAR. Where we work to support girls and women with disabilities to build their agency, get the skills they need to get employment opportunities, and also advocate for themselves. We believe greatly in self-advocacy. So we have been doing this work for the past 8 years now, where we work to link girls with disabilities with mentors who also have a disability. And I'm here in Maine with Juliet Wemmer, who is the lead for our Adolescent Girls and Women Empowerment Program. And she's been a mentor for a very long time. So we are able to link these girls with women who have had similar experiences to what they're going through. And these girls are able to support the girls through their menstruation. They are able to help the girls build their confidence. They're able to support the girls through their schooling, because what we've seen is girls lack mentorship, and that puts them even in higher risk of violence, in higher risk of discrimination. So having like a big sister work with them has played a huge role in helping the girls stay in school, and but also helping the girls know that there are other women who just like them have gone through similar experiences. Something that we've seen that has been a barrier to education for girls with disabilities is not having menstrual hygiene items when they're going through their menses. You've had stories where girls use cloths, socks, things they pick up off the streets during their menses, and that has led to many of them staying out of school for long durations of time. So we've been able to provide dignity kits, which is a kit with 6 months of pads, soap, just something that a girl can use to be clean and to help them through their menstruation durations. So we've done a lot of work around promoting menstrual hygiene, digital skills training and empowerment by women and girls with disabilities working together and supporting the younger girls, the upcoming generation, to also make it through school. Many girls with disabilities drop off really early in Kenya. Some don't even make it through primary school. And the few that make it to secondary school face big barriers like teachers thinking they cannot learn, parents unable to pay for even basic things like transportation to schools because they feel that that girl should not be in school. They'd rather pay for school fees for a sibling who doesn't have a disability than for the girl who has a disability. So you work really hard to make sure that girls stay in school, but also thrive in school and are able to get opportunities to succeed when they have completed their higher levels of education.
That just sounds like such amazing work. Kim, I want to turn to you because you've been on Maine Calling multiple times. You are a leader, you are an executive director, you are an advocate, but you are also a woman who has lived in Maine with a disability. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to share for those of us who do not have a disability, what kind of things you've encountered. Give us an example of how your life, what you encounter that you really ought not have to deal with.
Well, my disability, Jennifer, is that I was born with one arm, with part of one arm, I guess. And I didn't re as a young kid, I didn't really know. I just knew that I was a crippled child because I was born in 1962, and my grandmother pulled all the shades in the house because there was shame and sadness. I learned about that later. But really, I grew up in Yarmouth, which was, of course, all white, and both my parents were teachers, and so it wasn't too bad. It wasn't really until I went away to college. By then, I was handicapped instead of crippled, and it wasn't really until then that it hit me. And I looked around. I was at Wheaton College, a women's college in Norton, Mass, and I was so different. And I got it pretty quickly that it wasn't really that I was different. I wanted all the same things as all the other young women there, but it's that they had assumptions about me. They had lower expectations of me. They really kind of didn't, they wanted to stare at me, but they wanted to look away from me as well. So I guess that's when it really began, when I realized that people with disabilities every single day are faced with other people's assumptions of what we can and we cannot do. I think I love to say, tell people that I play pickleball, and that whenever, that's absolutely true, whenever I go to a new place to play pickleball, several people say to me, "Wow, you're amazing." And I'm not really, I'm just okay. But people had assumptions about me when they came onto the court. And what did they assume, right? That I wouldn't be as good as they would be. So, it's those assumptions that I think that we're fighting all the time. And like I said at the beginning, it's the assumptions that people make about us that make us so different from all of you. It's not that we're actually very different. And I think, we experience a lot of stigma in society, people with disabilities, and that makes sense. We were invisible for a very long time. We were in institutions. We weren't even, there wasn't even a law to mandate that we could be educated until 1973, for Pete's sake. Imagine that. We couldn't even, most of us weren't even in public school, let alone daycare. So it makes sense that these assumptions are there. They're kind of baked into society. We weren't part of communities. We weren't hanging around the village. We were elsewhere and we were other. And we're still pretty othered. And so we're working on that. That's what we work on. That's what we work on at Disability Rights Maine. And that's what we work on as a disability civil rights movement every single day of our lives.
Michelle Ames, can you tell us why you agreed to be on a radio show when you know that radio is inaccessible, usually, mostly to the deaf community?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. And I was surprised to be asked to join Maine Calling. As a deaf person, I don't listen to the radio. I've never tuned into Maine Calling, and I didn't even know it existed to some extent. And so, because that's not something that I access as a deaf person. So when I talked with my son, I said, "Hey, I'm joining Maine Calling." And we were just talking about the radio show and whatnot, and my son started laughing. And he's like, "Wow, that is going to be the quietest radio program they've ever experienced." And so, because I'm signing, right, he was under the impression that it would be a very quiet radio program, but it kind of helped ease a little bit of my nerves to have a little bit of a humor around it. And of course, we have an American Sign Language interpreter here today to support all of our access to each other. And when you decided to include the radio program on our YouTube channel, that meant that there was going to be more access for deaf viewers as well. And so I want to thank you for that.
Michelle, were you born deaf? And when you listen to Maria and Kim, do their stories and the statistics they share, do those all resonate with you as a woman with a disability?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, people with disabilities don't access information to the same extent. Oftentimes, we see a sheltering of folks with disabilities, and that othering absolutely is applicable, not feeling included in the general community. And so, I went to the School for the Deaf, and that was something I was born with the ability to hear, much like you. And so they discovered that I was deaf at 6 months years of old because I had spinal meningitis, and that was the reason that I became deaf. And so my mother knew that there was something going on because 1 month after being in the hospital, she was doing some projects in the house and dropped something rather loud, and I continued playing it. There was no audio cue for me whatsoever. And so she was trying to get my attention, but I didn't look at her. And so she said, "Okay, there's something going on here." And that's when the initial inkling that I was deaf, came to be. And so the doctor, when she brought me to the doctor, said, "Oh, give it some time. We'll see what happens here." But 3 years later, it was discovered that I was, in fact, deaf. And so my life was going to look a little bit different. And so I went to an audiologist. Now, I was born in Presque Isle, Maine, so way up north. And my whole family was there. But the audiologist that I had to see was in Portland. And so if you think about that, that's close to 300 miles. And so there I was, as a wee girl and driving all the way down to get this audio test. And that was confirmation for my mother that I was in fact deaf. In fact, I was identified as profoundly deaf. So that audiologist was actually somebody who was a child of a deaf adult. And so that person's name was Samuel Shirazo. And that person gave incredible resources to my parents. And my parents finally had some resources to know what came next for us. And so, about 2 years later, I was getting ready for school, and they had the Governor Baxter School for the Deaf. And at the time, it was called the Governor Baxter State School for the Deaf. And at later, they changed the name. So now it's Governor Baxter School for the Deaf. And in fact, we call it Maine Educational Center for Deaf and Hard of Hearing. And so we call it Maine, MECDHH for short. And so I went for a week, and we found out that that was a great fit for me. And that was where I was going to be able to get direct access in American Sign Language. And many of the teachers and caretakers there and house parents used American Sign Language. So it was going to be an accessible educational environment for me. So in the fall, they brought me there, they dropped me off, and I started my schooling. And now keep in mind, my parents were 300 miles away. And so I started picking up sign language and meeting peers. And at that time, deaf individuals, started building that connection. It was important for me to have that cultural identity that was being built and that similar lived experience and the stories that we were able to share and experience together. And so, of course, at that age, I was 5, and I was experiencing that separation from my parents. And I didn't go home until Thanksgiving. And so that definitely became something that was different, you know, and it was several years that I was separated from my family of origin and separated from my siblings. There were four of us in my family of origin. So there's a lot of layers. I don't want to, of course, steal the show with the stories, but I think that there's a lot of layers of similarities between the stories of other folks have shared today.
Mm. Well, thank you, Michelle. And Michelle will stay with us for the rest of the program, as well as Maria and Kim. We are talking about women and girls with disabilities in today's society. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, the challenges that women and girls with disabilities face and how to help overcome them. With me, Kim Moody, Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine, Maria Omare, advocate and educator who founded and directs the Action Foundation. She's a speaker at the Justice for Women Lecture Series here in Maine tomorrow night. And Michelle Ames, Program Director of Deaf Services with Disability Rights Maine. She's a teacher of American Sign Language and she is deaf. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. With us now is Margaret Cardoza, who is an advocate and was born with brain damage. She grew up in Maine and is now in her 60s. Margaret, thank you for joining us. Explain your medical background and how your disability came about.
Thank you for having me. I'm over 60 years old, so I'm not telling the exact amount.
That's fine.
Yes. My medical care in the 1960s involved that my mother received barbiturates and tranquilizers during her pregnancy with her. In those days, all assumed it was fine. It was not prenatally, and at birth, I had complications. Then the doctor had requested to euthanize me. Obviously, my parents advocated to keep me alive. And so with the brain damage in the school system for education issues, there were no laws in the 1960s. So, of course, in the public school, I was kicked out, labeled with the what we call the nasty R word, which is, hate to say it, retard. And because of that label, I was kicked out and segregated from the population. The laws had changed. And so I had gone back to the school I was kicked out of. And I was happy to tell them, I'm back. And as a result, they had no way of teaching me because they didn't know how. So most of my time was spent in what we used to call in those days, the cloak room, where we kept our coats. That was my room. So I wasn't really well educated, but I persevered and I went to college. And of course, there were still no laws in the early 1970s. So I used the Voc Rehab Act, Veterans Administration Section 504 law, even though I had no veteran relationships, to acquire accommodations. It was very difficult, but I received a bachelor's and a master's degree. Then in community life, finding a job, holding a job, holding relationships were not healthy and had so much difficulty until I received services from Vocational Rehabilitation Services. As a result, I was re-diagnosed with a speech and language disorder. I received speech and language services in a job as a in my former job as a self-advocacy coordinator. And today I totally am happy for all who I am, accepting all who I am, compensate for my disability, and definitely complement my abilities.
Margaret, thank you so much for taking part in this program. That was self-advocate Margaret Cardoza. And as she was speaking, Maria, I was thinking about you and the program that you run and that you find mentors for young women. And I was thinking what an amazing mentor Margaret would be.
Yes, I would be happy to continue relationships, especially mentoring. We need role models. And as you can hear with Michelle and Kim, and obviously Maria, there's great role models.
I'm going to go to Max, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Max, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to just like bring up a topic. It's not so much of a conversation, but a question. But yeah, so I'm a disabled person, and my disability is psychiatric in nature. I'm a person who gets SSDI. So yeah, first of all, I just wanted to say like thank you so much for having this today. I was really, really excited to see this today because I just feel like there's a real lack of representation just in our world, in our around us all the time. So I just really wanted to thank you for that. And then I just wanted to talk about like the medical model of disability versus the social model of disability. The medical model, obviously, I'm sure people can imagine what that might be like. And well, that's kind of the system that we are in now. And it regards disability as a physical or cognitive dysfunction residing in the individual body and or mind, a dysfunction that should be corrected and cured by medical intervention. In contrast, disability studies advances a social model contending that disability is a social construction, a set of social exclusions, obstructions, and degradations imposed on persons who diverge from the dominant abled, and that's in quotes, norm. The medical and social models of disability roughly correspond to the medical and social psychosocial iterations of madness. That's from a book called How to Go Mad Without Losing Your Mind. And so, yeah, and then I also just wanted to speak really quickly about, like, yeah, I want to make sure that all women with disabilities need to be helped, not just Americans. That I think, like, it's, like, single-handedly like a really important issue because when girls and women, and not just disabled girls but especially receive education, it does so much. I went to school for a little bit for sustainable agriculture, and I just learned about like how that it prevents gender-based violence and it allows families to be pulled out of poverty. So just like education for women and girls is very important.
Max, and thank you so much for calling in and being sharing your perspective. I want to turn to Kim Moody to respond to what you're saying. I have a feeling you are agreeing with most of what Max is saying, but is there any point that you would like to expand upon, Kim?
Well, yeah, I want to thank Max for bringing this into the show because we hadn't even gotten here yet. That really the focus for generations was on fixing us, on curing us. And, you know, I said earlier that I was born a crippled girl and then I was a handicapped young woman. And then I was a woman with a disability because we wanted people first. And now I am just proudly a disabled woman and I get to choose what I want to call myself, just like everybody else does. But we have a long way to go in moving in the way in which Max was talking about, where we don't want to be fixed. We just want to be employed and educated, and we don't want to live in institutions. And we want resources focused on kids with disabilities so that kids with disabilities can grow up and have summer jobs like every other kid and then go to college or gain the skills. We're done with this medical model of put us together in group homes and just let us live in poverty forever together. No, we want to learn skills. People want to be able to work. And I think, you know, I mentioned the word stigma before. There are many of us who don't want to work at combating stigma, again, air quotes, any longer, because we just need to prove ourselves. We just need to live next to you. We just need to show you that we can work hard and that we want all, like I said already, we want all of the same things that all of you want, including the money to live well. So yeah, thanks again, Max. That's great.
Max, thank you for your call. Joining us now is Juliette Muema. She is a visually impaired sustainable human development advocate, a paracyclist, competitive, and an inclusive women's rights advocate. She's also a speaker at the Justice for Women Lecture Series. Thank you for joining us, Juliette. Tell us a little bit about your background and your disability.
All right, thank you very much for having me. My name is Juliette Muema. I currently work at the Action Foundation Kenya as the Adolescent Girl and Women Empowerment Program Officer. I am a woman with disability. I am visually impaired. I was diagnosed with a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which basically just means a gradual loss of sight over time. It is a condition that affects the nerves. So at some point, I could read like normal font with magnifiers, but due to the nature of the condition, right now I am not able to read print. And like I said, the condition is a deteriorating one. Yes, and like you mentioned, I am a para athlete. I am the first paracyclist and para triathlete from Kenya, and I've represented the country in different stages of competitions. Yes, and I'm very humbled and proud to be here with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Juliette. I want to ask you what your advice is for others who experience severe challenges because of being a female and having a disability. I'm sure you work with young people. I'm looking at you. You're young yourself, but I'm sure you work with girls and women even younger than you. And what is it that you want to impart to them?
Very good question. Thank you for that. My advice is in life generally, there will always be challenges. I know someone once said that when you are a woman with disability, you have to work twice as hard to get half as far. So my advice to them is just to keep going, to not give up, that yes, there are hurdles. Like in the mentorship programs where we mentor older women with disabilities with younger girls with disabilities, it is just to role model to them that we have overcome these challenges. There were barriers, there were serious challenges along the way, and we made it. So my advice is basically that it is doable. The effort might be twice as hard, but the important thing is to not give up and to keep going.
All right. Yeah. Well, Juliette, thank you for joining us. Juliette Muema is visually impaired. She's an advocate for inclusive women's rights and is a competitive paracyclist. I'm going to go to Katie now, who's calling in from Portland. Hi, Katie. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. Thank you. Yeah. My name is Katie Thune, and my company is Mad Hatter Wellness. I'm calling from Portland. I'm here in Maine. But I'm from Minnesota, and I'm an educator, advocate, speaker, trainer, and most of the work that I do is on comprehensive sexual health for people with disabilities. And so I'm here for training with Disability Rights Maine, actually, and I see that there's some people on your panel from Disability Rights Maine, which is so great. And we will be training tomorrow some adults with disabilities to be co-facilitators in a curriculum. So they'll be peer educators in a way with the curriculum, comprehensive sexual health curriculum, that we hope would, when they're teaching this in groups, would
impact health, knowledge, empowerment, as well as to prevent sexual abuse and assault or
Katie,
unhealthy relations.
Katie, is it too late to get into that workshop? And if not, if people can attend, how do they find out about it?
That's great. I mean, this is through Disability Rights Maine, and so I think it would be, checking with that. But I would say absolutely, connect with someone there who could check with me, I think. And
okay.
I think we would love to have, a couple more adults with disabilities to be trained as peer educators.
Great. Katie and Kim, not to put you on the spot, but would you like to follow up to that?
Sure. I just put it in the chat. Yes, people can call 1-800-452-1948 to reach Disability Rights Maine and ask for Kate. And if you want to get into that training, that train the trainer training for tomorrow, that would be fabulous. We want you.
Great. Well, Katie, thanks for calling in. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're learning today about what many women with disabilities have experienced, including adding challenges to their gender. Today's show is being broadcast live on Maine Public's YouTube channel and on Maine Calling's Facebook page with an ASL interpreter. My guests are Maria Omare. She founded and directs the Action Foundation. Michelle Ames, Program Director for Deaf Services with Disability Rights Maine, and Kim Moody, Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine. If you're quick, you have time to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. We'll go to Chloe, who's calling from Lyman. Hi, Chloe. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm just calling as someone who has more of an invisible disability, what I would consider invisible. And I just wanted to kind of shed some light on that as girls and women who face disabilities that maybe aren't easily seen when they're out in public and how invalidating that can be. I think oftentimes we make assumptions about the health of someone based on how they look, and that ableism can just be so detrimental to mental health of young girls, and then also impact their physical health. Fear of using mobility aids or accessing services that as a disabled person, you should be able to access and you should feel comfortable accessing. So I just wanted to shed some light on that. And
Chloe,
the stigma that can be felt even by, even in a healthcare provider's office.
I think you've brought up some really important points. I'm going to start with you, Michelle, because I'm guessing that to many people, your disability is invisible unless they engage in a conversation with you. When you listen to Chloe speak, what would you like to add to that?
Hi there. Yes, absolutely. I think you definitely spoke to that well. I've experienced a situation before where I have two adult children now, but when they were young, they went to public school, and my daughter finished her middle school career and went off to high school. And then my son joined the same middle school that she had. And so my daughter and I went to the middle school, and the teacher went up to me and then passed me to talk with my daughter about the educational experience of her brother and talk about what was happening in the classroom. And for me, that completely threw me off and insulted me. Because I felt, just because I'm a deaf person, you think that you can just completely bypass me and talk to my daughter about my son's education? And so what I said was, I'm the mother, you talk to me. And I think that that threw this person off a little bit, but absolutely. I noticed that sometimes somebody will look at me and start to talk to me. And then when they recognize that I'm deaf, they'll start to talk to somebody else next to me. But what you have to keep in mind is the person that's standing next to the deaf person might not always be a safe person to be interpreting information between the two of you. And that can become actually a form of exploitation. And that's something that we've seen in our community where people are bypassing deaf people and are talking to another person in their home that actually might be somebody that's responsible for domestic violence or intimate partner violence. And so it has to be really mindful when you're talking with a deaf person, when you're using somebody around to interpret, you need to make sure that you're cautious and you're being mindful.
Thank you so much for that insight, Michelle. And Kim, I want to ask you about something else Chloe said about using aids that people have a right to. I'm listening to Chloe. I'm a mom. It's hard enough to be a teenage girl, especially today. It's hard enough to feel as though you're never good enough. You never are as good as everybody on social media. And then the added stigma that you might perceive of using a tool that would help you. I'm just as a mom feeling heartbroken by that comment. Kim.
Yeah, definitely. It is so hard for kids. They're teased, they're belittled, they're harassed. You know, it really is. I mean, I've tried to be as positive as possible today because there's been so much change in the years that I've been doing this work, but that still remains to be sure. And so that's why we have to normalize it, Jennifer. That's why we have to get kids into school from day one. Instead of we segregate kids from the beginning of their educational career. And so when they come back, the regular kids, again, air quotes, are surprised to see them and have the low expectations of them. So let's get kids into the classrooms and make sure that they're fully educated and learning the same skills as all the other kids.
Chloe,
it's hard enough.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. Maria, I want to turn to you and ask you what you would like people who are listening today, who perhaps may not have thought deeply about this topic before, what kind of information, what kind of way of thinking you would like people to have moving forward?
Yeah, thank you, Jen. But before I answer that, I want to add weigh in on what Chloe said about, the different misconceptions about a disability. In the time that I have been here in Maine, and when I'm with Juliet, we're ordering a meal, for example, people will assume that I am the one to say what Juliet is supposed to eat. When we are walking about, people assume that I'm the one who's supposed to speak for Juliet, and yet Juliet has a voice. Juliet can get around on her own. So I'd like people to also recognize that people with disabilities and girls with disabilities, women with disabilities have agency and they can speak for themselves. And we don't have to do everything for them. They can actually do a lot of things just on their own. We just have to give them a chance. So what would I want people to take out from this conversation and from our experience is that disability rights are human rights. People with disabilities need to have the same access to opportunities. In our country, children with disabilities don't even make it to the classroom. Children with disabilities don't make it to public spaces because of the misconceptions that people have about them. So I'd like people to know that for us to have stronger communities, we have to include them early. On to what Kim said, kids with disabilities, I believe, thrive, and every child thrives when we include children early from their schooling going forward. So it's really important for us to make sure that children with disabilities are included early in school. The Action Foundation does a lot of work around promoting inclusive education, and we have seen that that has opened a lot of opportunities to the girls and women that we are supporting.
We'll go to Anne, who's calling from Bethel. Hi, Anne, go ahead.
Hi, I was calling first to commend you on this wonderful topic. I've been a special education teacher all of my life, but have recently evolved into a person with a disability in that I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I lost my vision almost 30 years ago, and have now developed further complications which involve my ability to walk and move independently. So what I'm finding difficult is just simple access to stores and concert venues and auditoriums. Does the door open the right way? Can I get in with my dog? Do people reject my dog? So I'm no longer using a dog because of my own physical needs, but that in itself is a topic all on its own. But the other thing is access for blind or vision impaired folks. So much of what you're talking about today is regarding hearing impaired folks, which is vitally important. But for the blind, there are things like I'm a diabetic and I need to access a pump for proper insulin delivery. However, it's not accessible to the blind. So if an alert goes off and my partner isn't home, I listen to an alert and listen and listen and listen because I can't turn it off myself. And when you talk to companies, research and development is interested in accessing for people with vision impairments. They want people to use it. And I totally get it. However, diabetes is the second leading cause of blindness. And we are out here trying to access these tools, and they're unavailable to us. Computers are difficult. They're coming, but they're difficult. Phones, also tremendously difficult. Everything you see is remarkably difficult. And then the other comment I have is about women with disabilities feeling their place in the community as beautiful citizens. I struggle every day because I can't look in the mirror and tell, is my lipstick on right? Is my hair okay? And I have a remarkable partner who will say, oops, which is great. But feeling beautiful wherever you go should be human rights, because it doesn't matter what a disability may look like or what an ability may look like. Feeling beautiful in your community is really, really important.
Anne, thank you so much for calling in. Kim, what would you like to say to Anne?
Well, thank you for calling in. And thanks for teaching our kids. I wish they weren't in special rooms, but thank you for that work all of your life. I think my biggest takeaway from this is really that Anne can call the IRIS Network if she hasn't and get some assistance there. But my biggest takeaway is that disability happens to people. And so, I mean, I figure I had it pretty easy being born with a disability because I got to get used to it from the day I could first breathe. But disability happens. And so I was talking with friends the other day about how Maria said that sometimes disability is seen as contagious, and they're talking literally contagious. But in my life, I've seen people think disability is contagious, not so literally, like, oh boy, let's ignore that and maybe it will go away, or let's pretend she doesn't exist and then it might not happen to us. But it happens to people. And as we age, the chances of us gaining a disability really become much greater. So I think that we really need to accept the fact that disability is just a natural part of the human experience. And we don't want to be taken care of. We want to be equal partners in this society.
And I wanted to, we just have a little bit of time left, Kim, but I want to return to that idea that you don't want to be taken care of. You want to be an equal partner. Yet those horrible statistics about sexual assault in women with disability, I do feel as though it is incumbent upon the rest of us to at least be more alert, more aware, to look for signs and to watch out for people we know and care about who are vulnerable. Would you not agree with that?
Well, I don't think that that's I think it's just slightly off point, Jennifer, because when I say that we don't want to be taken care of, I'm talking about the billions of dollars that are spent in the disability, what I call the disability industrial complex, where people with disabilities are seen as vulnerable. So they are put under guardianship and they are put in group homes, and those places do not keep them safe. Those places put them at greater risk. And sometimes being under guardianship puts people at greater risk. So that's what I mean by that.
And as far as taking care of one another, we all ought to be taking care of one another and looking out for one another. no matter what our ability or disability.
Agreed.
I want to thank all of you for joining me today. Michelle Ames, Program Director of Deaf Services with Disability Rights Maine. Kim Moody, the voice you just heard, Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine. And Maria Omare, Disability Inclusion Advocate, Social Entrepreneur, Educator, and Executive Director of the Action Foundation. She is the featured speaker at the Justice for Women Lecture Series that is tomorrow night, Thursday, September 26th at 6:30 p.m. at Hannaford Hall at the University of Southern Maine, and it is free. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. We had additional help from Nick Godfrey. He enabled us to stream this. Thank you to Ava Hallowell for being the ASL interpreter for this program. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, we will discuss the need for nuance in the way that we think and talk to one another. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.